Hey everybody, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks weekly podcast. We've got a couple of great interviews lined up for you today. First, we welcome a special guest. I don't know, should I identify him? Well, he's the CEO of the company that is mentioned in the title and is our number one newsmaker. So you can connect those dots, but we'll talk about the newest surgical robot in town. I'll leave it at that. And then a little later on, I'll speak with Chad Hoskins. He's the CEO of PhayGenesis. PhayGenesis has a neurostimulation therapy for dysphagia, which is the inability to swallow. It can help stroke survivors and others in the space. So interesting conversation with Chad, not only about the company, but also about his career. He's led a few twists and turns, and I always like to follow those paths closely. So I know you'll enjoy those conversations. Well, speaking of conversations, we'll be gathering next Tuesday at Device Talks Tuesday with our friends from Resonetics. The title of their discussion is Advancing MedTech with Custom Electromechanical Sensors from Design to Deployment. So discussion will be talking a great deal about sensors. Resonetics always digs deep, always gives a great presentation, filled with insights, knowledge, and data. So I hope you'll join us on our Device Talks Tuesdays episode, which is happening at 4 p.m. on Tuesday. You can watch that for free. Just register at devicetalks.com. You can watch it live. You can watch it on demand. I should say you can register for free. You can watch it live. You can watch it on demand. You can ask questions either way. But we're starting to use the chat function on our we started that this week on our Device Talks Tuesdays. So had a lot of great discussions with attendees to this past week's Device Talks Tuesdays. Expect we'll do more next Tuesday. So try to be live, try to be there, try to be engaged, and definitely register for Device Talks Tuesdays. Other than that, we're working on our agendas for Device Talks Boston, Device Talks Minnesota, which is returning to Minnesota on June 11th at the McNamara Alumni Center. And of course, we're working on Device Talks West, which takes place almost a full year from now. But yeah, I'm on it. I've already got a keynote scheduled, secured. So happy to be, I'll be happy to bring you that news a little later on. So we're busy at work here at Device Talks, making the best darn med tech content and the best darn, organizing the best darn med tech conferences you could ever ask for. But you're here to listen to this podcast. So let's get this episode started. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Chris Newmarker, how are you, sir?
Doing well, Tom, doing well. Happy Halloween. We're talking on Halloween today.
We are talking on Halloween. It's an interesting time of year. Chris, I'm gonna get up on my soapbox. We don't normally, you know, take positions on this podcast. We love all of our device talkers, and you know, everyone has their own personal beliefs and followings and allegiances, but
sure.
I have to take this moment just to say, as a Red Sox fan, I really enjoyed the Yankees falling to pieces last night. So, sorry, Yankee fans. I really am sorry. I've been there. It hurts.
It sucks.
But, yeah, that was my life for 35 years. So,
as someone who's seen many Twins seasons in Minneapolis where it's like all we have to do is just get through the Yankees and we can – advance in the playoffs.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I remember those times. I was like, well, go get them, Twins. And then I was like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, okay. Yeah, so.
Yeah, it's nice.
Sorry about that, Yankee fans, kind of.
It kind of sucks for you.
And this is fresh off my watching the comeback on Netflix, which, you know, just sort of the first two episodes were all about Yankee fans telling Red Sox fans how, you know, we just don't know how to win and they know how to win. So there's some built-in re-energized trauma that's fueling my comments. So I'll stop there because
I really do love everyone in Device Talks land.
Oh my gosh, the comeback. Is that about the 05 series?
04, yes. 04.
04, yeah. 04. Yeah. Sorry, 04. Sorry. Yeah. That was a great series. Oh my gosh.
It's a very good Netflix special. It's done by the children of Mike Barnicle, who was the Boston Globe columnist whose career took a left-hand turn. But his kids can make a documentary. They made another one about the Isabel Gardner Stewart Museum theft, which was very good. That's also
That was fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, this is a robbery.
Exactly.
That's great.
I wanted to. I'm like, oh, these Barnacle kids, you know, they got lucky once, and then like, oh, and we did the Isabel Gardner Museum. I'm like, oh, right, that was very good too. Okay, I guess they're good at this. So good for them.
Boston has some great stories.
Yeah. In fact, I was listening to a podcast with I think it was one of the Barnacles, and he said, yeah, he's like, the irony is that like the Isabel Gardner Museum is like 200 yards from Fenway. So both of their documentaries came like within this square mile of Boston. So that's just one square mile.
They should do a Big Dig documentary next. that'd be great. So it'd be like 50 episodes or something.
Yeah. Thanks for the Big Dig, by the way. That was great. The $13 billion or whatever it ended up costing. It really has helped a lot. So we're grateful, America. Thank you for that.
You can get me to go on and on about the Southwest Light Rail project of Minneapolis.
That should be a documentary. That's just gets sizzle written all over it. So,
I mean, come on. It's easy to tunnel under some lakes. It's easy, and the train's gonna come up out of the lake, and like what?
We do it in Boston. Hey, the Sumner and Callahan Tunnel, they go under the Mystic River. I mean, it's lots of cities do it. You know, New York.
I love civil engineering. It's great.
No, it's true. It has been done many times, and it has been done a long time ago. So I don't see any reason not to do it again.
And
so,
it's nice to see us doing it again in America. Like let's build some stuff.
That's right. So. Let's build some stuff here. So
just build it.
Anyway.
All right.
That's my soapbox. I don't want to offend anybody.
Nice that, you know, the one other than also being major medical device hubs, both Boston and Minneapolis both have baseball teams that hate you just have that. Like, the Yankees. Yeah. Like, woo, go down. Yeah. Like, go Dodgers. Yeah. That's great.
And I don't think the Santa Clara.
Glad we could share that. Glad we could share that, Tom.
Yeah. We finally have united on one cause. Speaking of baseball in Minnesota, Minnesota Device Talks Minnesota happening June 11th. And as I think you mentioned on the podcast previously, if not, maybe it was on Private Conversations, but the Twins are playing, I think, the Rangers those 3 days, including a day game the day after Device Talks Minnesota. So we're going to be going to that afternoon game, I think. So if Device Talkers want to join us there, by all means, reach out. We'll have a party.
Yeah.
Let's figure it out.
That'd be awesome.
I don't know what that's going to look like, but and I'm sure marketing's going to be like, what did you say on your podcast? But let's figure it out. That'd be cool to hang
with. I'll get one of those Karma Chex sausage sandwiches I always like to get at a Twins game, or maybe turkey to go. I like turkey to go too. That's a good stadium food.
But I will buy a beer for every person who comes up and says Newmarker's Newsmakers at that baseball
game. Oh my gosh, sounds
great.
There
you go. All right.
Love it.
Come to base at Newmarker's Newsmakers. I'm buying you a beer or a beverage.
Are you going to buy them a craft beer, or are you just going to get them a Miller or
get whatever beer they want, man.
Whatever beer they want.
Yeah,
want a good Summit.
Absolutely. I don't – yeah, no, I'm a simple man, Chris. I don't really need many luxuries in life, but when I drink beer, I'm particular. Beer and coffee is the two areas in life where I don't compromise.
So you're not one of those like baseball fans. It's like at a ballpark, I get the Bud or I get the Miller.
That's what's available. I'll obviously take it, but I'm one of these like, well, is it hoppy? I'm that guy. Like, how hoppy is your IPA? That guy.
Is it an IPA? Is it a hazy IPA?
I still don't know what that means.
Hazy IPA.
I mean, I know what it looks like, and I know it makes you pucker until your eyes cross. But yeah. But anyway,
it's delicious. Yes.
So Yankee fans, sorry. Dodgers fans, congratulations. Twins fans and Red Sox fans will sit behind and just kind of snicker.
Yeah.
And
feel a little Schadenfreude at the Yankees.
Whole lot of Schad and a whole lot of Freud, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Sometimes we just get those little joys in life.
Anyway, do you have any news for us, Chris?
Yes. You know, we did have MedTech news this week. The new markers, newsmakers. So let's get rolling on this. And whatever you just heard, Tom and I say, I'm sure he edited the heck out of this to make it
I don't
shorter,
know. This is all pure gold, but we'll see what remains.
It's good stuff.
What is number five, Chris Newmarker?
Well, number five on the list, we've got news from Medtronic. They had positive long-term outcomes with their Simplicity Spiral renal denervation system. I mean, it was a long road for Medtronic to get it approved. They finally got landmark approval for the system in last November, like so nearly a year ago. But, I mean, this is Medtronic looks at this as a multi-billion dollar opportunity. High blood pressure is extremely difficult to control, especially with, you know, the pharmacy, you know, making sure you have the right pharmaceuticals. And this is increasingly appearing to be like a really good option that maybe you just get this minimally invasive procedure where you get something zapped and, you know, to treat your hypertension. Yep.
And we were fortunate enough at Device Talks West. And this is actually the first time we've had a podcast since Device Talks West, which went very well.
Yeah.
People had a really great time.
That was fantastic.
And we had Jason Weidman, who, of course, leads this business at Medtronic, give a presentation about the power of persistence. And this is an area that the technology, rather, that's going to be applied to other areas as well. So it's nice to see MedTech sort of lending an assist to people who sometimes really have no other options, or they're just facing a lifetime of expensive drugs, and sometimes a procedure can make things make things somewhat better. So great news from Medtronic for sure.
Health providers definitely pushing people to, you know, get their blood pressure controlled at earlier and earlier ages. Yep. Because, you know, if you let high blood pressure be uncontrolled, I mean, it's going to have all kinds of other, you know, health problems, including higher risk of heart attack, all kinds of stuff. So this is great.
Excellent news. All right, Chris Newmarker, let's roll on to number four, a very interesting number four.
Yeah, my gosh. So number four on the list is, we've talked about how Joe Kiani, the CEO of Masimo, he left after losing a bitter proxy fight with Peloton Capital Management. And now he's getting sued by the company he co-founded, which is just, wow.
That's, I don't know if that's necessary.
Yeah, I can't say anything else. You know,
I mean, it seems a little much, but what are they suing him over?
You know, they're suing him in the in federal court in New York, and it's over what they said was like kind of an empty. They're claiming that there was like some empty voting scheme going on. You know, I think this was around the proxy fight. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was like they're trying to basically one of, you know, we had. They're saying that him and an investment firm, RTW Investments, that there was like, you know, basically this thing to, you know, get RTW extra vote to artificially increase their influence before the proxy battle. So, you know, now the company's claiming this wasn't properly disclosed, and they're suing him and RTW. So we'll see how that plays out.
We will see how that plays out. It seems as if we thought the story was at its end, but it continues on. So, and this is
and we did reach out to Kiani and RTW, you know, for comments from them or their lawyers. So, you know, we'll see what we get from them in the future around, like, you know, their side of all this. So.
And this is written by Daniel Kerr, senior editor of Daniel Power.
Senior editor Daniel Kerr.
And number five was written by associate editor Sean Hooley. All right, Chris. What is number four, Chris Newmark? Another Danielle Kirsch article.
Yeah, another article from Danielle. Danielle's been writing up a storm this week. So, you know, number three on the list, we had Exactech filing, you know, Chapter 11 bankruptcy restructuring. They were hit with a lot of litigation around hip and knee products, you know, recalls, you know, between 2021 and 2022. And looks like their business just took a real hit from that. So now they're going through this restructuring process to, you know, hopefully, you know, come out on the other side, you know, like in a better financial position. I mean, they were saying overall they've been seeing like, you know, positive growth in 2024, but they're just being weighed down with, you know, these you know, charges related to liabilities. So, the restructuring also is including like a $85 million financing commitment that, you know, should allow them to maintain operations during this process. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this player in the orthopedic device space, we'll see how they come out of the other side of this.
Exactech's a fairly big name in orthopedics, so obviously yeah. Not one of the bigger players, but yeah, we'll hopefully they'll find their way through the other side of this. So
yeah, it looks like they have investment partners working with them on this. So
all right, so let's.
So you know, sometimes companies just have to do that, go through that process.
If we look up at the scoreboard, so number five, we'd put that in the good news column. Number four, bad news column. This one, bankruptcy. Yeah. All right. So what? Yeah. What's number two? Let's see.
Number two. I mean, it's good news for Minnesota.
Oh,
actually.
Here we go, Minnesota.
Come on,
you held on to one of your three medtech headquarters. Good for you.
Yeah, come on. We got Medtronic.
I saw the map.
That should count. My gosh, I'm never gonna. I think Medtronic should at least count for two. Tom, come on. But yes, we had a major medtech company here, and the open question was whether it was going to stay based here. I mean, 3M spun off their healthcare business as a new independent company, Solventum, and they're being, you know, run initially out of 3M's headquarter campus in Maplewood, just east of St. Paul. But, you know, the big question was, were they going to stay in Minnesota? And now we've got, Solventum. They're going to be spending $209 million to like revamp a former health insurer office space south of the cities.
Cool.
In Eagan. Yeah. So it's going to, the state's chipping in $13 million. To help out, and they're saying this is going to retain 2,000 jobs around here.
Well, that's good news for sure. And of course, we have fun about Minnesota, but I'm excited, so excited to be back in Minnesota. And Chris, you and I had some great calls this week regarding programming for Device Talks Minnesota. A lot of enthusiasm around it, so we're definitely excited.
I'm really excited.
Yeah, I am too. I miss Minnesota. I haven't been back for a couple of years. Since we attended another conference, we won't talk about that.
Yeah, some other conference.
All right. Well,
no, this is good.
So that's good news.
I always thought Device Talks Minnesota played a really great role in the ecosystem around here. You know, especially like getting some like really, you know, cool names, you know, from elsewhere in the country too, to come in, you know, and interact with, you know, people in this hub. So, I mean, yeah, I'm really pumped that we've got this going again next June 11th at the McNamara Alumni Center at the University of Minnesota.
Absolutely. No, and we don't have any names to share yet in terms of speakers, but we're certainly, we are working with a lot of folks in the area to build up programming, but we're definitely working with some of the larger OEMs, hopefully get some of their senior execs there to speak as well. So it'll be a good representation of the broader medtech industry. So that's a good column one. And that's written by a young man named Chris Newmarker, who's got a lot of promise. So
yeah,
a lot of promise.
I think he can go somewhere.
I think so. Yeah, we all hope he does anyway. But
right.
But a bump.
Somewhere
else.
Somewhere good. Whoa, Tom.
Just having some fun.
Cold. I'm not a Yankees fan.
No, you're not. What did you grow up with rooting for, by the way, being in Ohio? You were an Indian fan, or did you have a team growing up?
Indians.
It was... You were kind of in the middle, right?
Indians.
Okay, close.
I grew up north of Columbus. I kind of feel like Columbus is kind of that borderline between, you know, Indians and no, Guardians, sorry.
Guardians yes,
and Reds.
Yes, Guardians. So, yes. We were talking with a colleague of ours who's a Guardians fan, and I asked her about Tito Francona's move to the Reds, and she wasn't happy about it. She kind of sees this.
I
didn't realize there was a little bit of interstate rivalry going on between the two, but she.
You gotta have interstate rivalry.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
I mean, even though they're American League and National League, you know, it's fun. It's fun when you get those interleague games.
I wish Boston still had a National League team. That would be a ton of fun. But, all right. So, Chris Neumarker.
Going to get the Braves back from Atlanta.
Exactly. Let's see if we can. Yeah, exactly. Let's see if we can pull them back. So, we're tied 2-for-2. Good news, bad news. So, number one's the tiebreaker, Chris Neumarker. What's number one?
And we've got good news.
Good news. Woo-hoo! Ding, 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 ding.
Always nice to have good news. So we have number one on the list from Sean Hooley. We've got Distal Motion winning FDA nod for their Dexter surgical robots. So we've got another robotic system approved in the U.S. here.
Yes, well, I'm certainly glad that Distal Motion is your number one, because we just happen to have with us in studio Greg Roach, the CEO of Distal Motion. Welcome to the podcast, Greg.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
So We've got some great news from Distal Motion. Congratulations on your FDA approval of Dexter. Before we get into that, though, earlier on in the talk, Chris and I were talking about the World Series. You're a Cleveland area person. Are you a Guardians fan, I imagine?
I am a Guardians fan with a big dislike of the Yankees.
So what was the most positive news for you this week? Like your robot getting an FDA nod, or the Yankees going down in flames? What do you think?
I think the de novo approval slightly edged out the Yankees blowing the lead last night. Yeah, for sure. But just ever so slightly. Yeah. Remember, I always tell people Cleveland's payroll is a third of New York's. So I wish sometime baseball might think about changing that.
Well, as a Boston fan, I disagree with that entirely. I just wish my team would spend the money that we're giving them. But anyway, we'll move on. So let's go to the other news of the week, your FDA approval of Dexter. Introduce our listeners. I know you were on the podcast earlier this year, but remind folks about your Dexter robot. What makes it special?
Yeah. So, Distal Motion has been in existence now going on 13 years, which I think most people don't know. So there's been a lot of time and thought into what Dexter is. Dexter is a soft tissue robot, that will play in the abdominal space, focused on urology, gynecology, general surgery. We do all of those surgeries currently under our CE mark in Europe. And then, this week we received our first indication approval under the de novo umbrella. So we got marketing authorization this week for inguinal hernia repair in adults, which is defined as 22 and older.
And can you talk a bit about the robot itself, the structure, what it looks like, and how it's different? So we've got... It's funny that you say you've been around 13 years. We talk about Mira and Virtual Incision like it's a new startup. That's been around for 15 years. Like all these startups that have been around for over a decade are entering our peripheral vision of surgical robotics.
It takes so long to hit milestones. Like we're the only industry where it's like we have companies that are over a decade older, or like still calling them like startups and stuff. So
yeah. I think you go from startup to scale up to a commercial company. That's kind of the genesis. But yeah, to answer your question, Tom, Dexter is small form factor. So when we think about the typical form factor of a robot, you have modular designs and then you have the boom mounted robots. Ours is modular in nature, very small, very compact, easy to move. But it also, one of the big differences for us is the surgeon is sterile. So the surgeon's sterile, the console has incredible access to the patient. I always say that Dexter integrates into the workflow of a laparoscopic surgeon, provides the benefits of what a robot typically does, which is, the ability to work in confined space with wristed instruments and make suturing and dissection much, much easier for them. So it does all of that, but also gives them the benefit of getting to the patient. And we think there's some big applications down the road for having that type of access, in what I'll say are the budding sites of care in the ambulatory surgery centers here in the U.S. and outpatient surgical hospitals. We have a single-use instrument. So we know in those sites of care, sterilization can be a burden, and we tried to remove that. And you know, now that we got the first approval, obviously we're going to go out and do a bunch of hernia surgeries, and we'll continue with the FDA, which has been a great partnership for us to try and drive indication expansion over the next year and a half, 2 years, so that we can make this product, which I think is incredibly important for both surgeons and administrators, to make it be able to be utilized across all three verticals of surgery that I mentioned before.
So what is the significance of the surgeon is sterile? And what is that difference from some of the others out there, the market leaders? We won't mention names, but why is that? What does it mean and why is that important?
Yeah. So I think number one, it's an incredible safety feature, right? So if you need to get to the patient, you don't have to break down the robot. You can move it away in seconds, literally seconds, and you can address things, you know, from a laparoscopic perspective. So it's incredibly safe, and that's demonstrated. You know, we've done 1,300 plus procedures in Europe, and we have not had a major adverse event, which I think is really, really unique, and we're really proud of. So it's incredibly safe. The other thing is, you know, when you're adapting robotics, you can learn at your own pace. You know, so we see a lot of our surgeons that implement robotics in 30% of the case, then 50, then 70, and then 100. So it allows them to do the things that they know at first, and I call it kind of the double parachute effect, right? You're not just jumping out of a plane. You really are jumping out of a plane, but have some backup. So it allows easy integration for them. The workflow, you know, that's one of the things we really tried to focus on, is not, you know, make the workflow simple and also make the workflow adaptable to a laparoscopic workflow, which is why I say you integrate Dexter into the workflow of the surgeon. And the final thing I would say is it allows surgeons to use what we feel are best in class complementary products. So there are great companies relative to stapling, advanced energy, visualization, advanced visualization, so ICG, you know, and I would say some of these technologies are better than the technologies found on your traditional robots. And now you have the best of both worlds. You can use a world-class robot with best-in-class instrumentation that is preferential to that surgeon in that particular procedure.
What does the field like looking forward in terms of penetration for ASCs, for surgical robotic systems? Are there other systems that are currently being sold in those to those centers? Are you competing with other systems? Or is this a space that you kind of have to yourself at this point? I mean, Moon Surgical obviously can. Mirror, I think, will be in there as well. So I'm kind of answering my own question. But for what Dexter does, what does the competition look like for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a reason why there's not a high prevalence of robotics in ASCs. There's just not. Are there robots in ASCs? Yes, there are. But the rooms are big. You know, there's a lot of barriers: cost, personnel, sterilization, size. You know, so form factor. There's all kinds of things that have prohibited this from happening. I do think that the good thing about Dexter is, you know, it kind of breaks down all the barriers I just mentioned. You know, it solves the form factor. You know, the logistics and staff. It's really easy to set up. You don't need much there. You know, we think will be financially disruptive. So it's kind of, you know, solving all the things that have really prevented, you know, a big movement into this site of care in the past.
You were involved in one of the earlier surgical robotic systems at Rosa Zimmer, sort of led that business group. Now you're leading Dexter, which is a completely different, or sorry, Distal Motion, which has Dexter, a completely different surgical robotic system. How would you relate the two systems? Are we a next generation of surgical robotics family? Are we a younger cousin? Like, have we completely jumped over to a new type of surgical robotic system that we're going to be seeing sort of take over the field going forward? Or would you say Dexter and others are more iterations of the earlier models?
Yeah, I believe in segmentation of the marketplace. And I think there's robots, you know, the market leader has a very advanced and good robot. I mean, and there's a place for that. And I think there's a large place for Dexter. And, you know, I look at Rosa, right? We did a lot of our business in the ASC and, before kind of that movement in competition, there wasn't a lot of business done in the ASC. And now I think if you look at orthopedic robotics, I mean, most of the robots are being sold into those sites of care. So I do believe in segmentation. I think there's the right robot for the right site of care, the right procedures. You know, we at DistalMotion built a robot that is made for low acuity, high volume surgery. And that's a little bit different than making a robot that's built around the complex that you're trying to flex down. And I always say we built something for, because there's all kinds of factors that prohibit that, right? Cost being one of those. But we built a robot that was made for low acuity, high volume surgery that has the ability to flex up. And that's a much different thing. So I think there's places for all those that we talked about. And I think the market's going to allow for multiple competitors. But we think we really have a great chance to take a lot of share in the market that I just described in the U.S.
Yeah, so you were talking about, just the affordability factor of it. I mean, anything you could kind of tell us about how much more affordable this would be than, kind of like these big robotic, systems that we've, seen in the past?
Yeah, I don't want to talk price on the call, but I'll say one thing that would probably make it pretty obvious, right? Which is, I always break it down when I say robotics is hard, and I learned this at Avatera. When you have to build a robot, you have to build a complementary set of instruments. You have to build a visualization system, and not just a visualization system, 3D, 4K, ICG, or maybe hyperspectral, multispectral imaging. Then you have kind of the data AI component, and you have telesurgery or telehealth. So you have all these vectors. It's impossible and also very expensive. We stripped out all but two. We have a killer robot, what we think is a world-class robot in a very deliberate set of complementary instruments. That is it. Will we expand later on? Of course, there's areas in digital and things that we're interested in. But right now, we're staying focused. And I think one of the beautiful things and why I joined DistalMotion was they had the ability to say no. They said no to a lot of different work streams to focus on what's really good. And that I think that track record is shown in how we're performing surgery in Europe right now.
It kind of sounds like you didn't build a Porsche, you built a good, sturdy Jeep. It's like...
Yeah, well, I would make your analogy a little different. I would say if you're going to Starbucks, you probably don't need a Formula One race car. You can drive a Porsche. That's the way I would say it.
Good Porsche. Okay.
Excellent. All right, Craig Roche. Well, congratulations. Hopefully we'll have you tell DistalMotion's story at a Device Talks event next year. We'd love to have you back.
Yeah.
Thanks
look
for your
forward
time.
To it, guys. Thanks so much.
Yeah, great to see you, Greg.
All right, well, thanks again to Greg Roche for joining us. Just a bit of a programming note. Greg did not sit in on the entire New Markets Newsmakers. He obviously came in at the end. I just wanted to make that clear. Second programming note, we're going to have our next interview with Chad Hoskins of Phagenesis. I hate bad audio. It's just a pet peeve of mine. I hate when podcasts have bad audio. If you want to know what makes a good podcast, there are lots of things that make a good podcast, but one of them is having good audio. All that being said, somehow I didn't push the right button or whatever not on this next interview, and I use the internal mic for my side of the interview. I think Chad sounds fine, but I sound muffled, and I'm just cheesed about it. But I just wanted to give you a heads up. I also cleared my throat a few times because I remember having some kind of cough or something, and I got most of them, but there's one or two left in there for you to enjoy. So pardon the bad audio coming up. I hate it. I hope be able to hear past it and enjoy a great conversation about a med tech career and about a very cool company. All right, let's go. Well, Chad Hoskins, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Really great to be here.
I'm really fascinated about Phagenesis and about the area you're focusing in. I'm been con-
increasingly drawn to sort of med techs that are treating people after an event like stroke, where we talk a lot about stroke companies. I think it's great that we're spending more time talking about the people who've had strokes and helping them regain what they can of their as much of their lives as they can, as we can help them regain. So I want to get into that story, of course. But anyone who listens to this podcast know that we like to start off with the people on the podcast and learn a bit about their path into med tech. So Chad, how did you find your way into the med tech industry?
Yeah, you know, I was a failed pre-med in college. So I have a long family of physicians.
Your poor mother, I'm sure she's still talking.
Well, actually, my father. I'm the first generation male not to go into medicine between both my mom and dad's family.
Oh, so, really?
was failed, but it was always interested in healthcare. You know what I mean? And like when I was in high school, I actually followed around a cardiothoracic surgeon for 4 or 5 weeks, watching surgeries, and was just always sort of driven towards the healthcare field. And so actually started out of college as a pharmaceutical sales rep. So carried a bag for Alcon Labs for a while, which was at the time an independent standalone ophthalmology company. Ended up doing that, ended up, you know, sort of spending time there and deciding, okay, what am I going to go do next? And went back to grad school. And it was at grad school, I'd been in the pharma world and I liked healthcare. I liked the business side of healthcare, but I just found pharma a little big and a little slow for me. And so was drawn to devices and med tech in particular, just because as you know well, right, the product cycles are different. The impact you see with patients is different. The ability to get hands-on is different. So as part of that, as I was in business school, I was looking at opportunities and ended up at Cordis Endovascular, actually, for my summer internship during business school. And so part of the J&J umbrella, that was really how I sort of first got my first entree into medical devices.
Just looking at your education, so I see Georgetown undergrad, but Columbia University, Master of Public Health, and then Wharton, your MBA, two master's degrees, huh? You're just...
Well, you know,
trying to make up for not getting into medical, not going to medical school.
Yeah, I was like, Dad, I can get a graduate degree. I'm okay. That would just sort of happen to be happenstance. So, in parallel to my career path, I met my wife in college. We were dating through this period of time. I was living in New York. I ended up marrying a physician instead of becoming one. I thought that would be easier. But ended up, she was in med school in DC. And I had originally started doing the MPH MBA program at Columbia. And I knew I wanted to do a healthcare focus for my business degree. So that's how the MPH came into the picture. Well, fast forward, she ended up matching for her residency at Wills Eye Hospital in Philadelphia. And so I just decided I would try to transfer to Wharton to be in Philadelphia so we could be together. And Wharton also has an awesome healthcare program, which I was a part of. And so that was really the genesis of how those two things came together. But, you know, I will say the MPH ended up being a really valuable
fit in?
Well, you know, MPHs, I was in the healthcare management program, gives you much more of a payer provider lens than I would say a business program gives you. You know, I think business programs end up being very, especially at Wharton, end up being very finance consulting oriented, or end up being very device pharma oriented and industry focused. Mm-hmm. There's not as many people who spend time going deeper on the sort of situations or issues associated with providers, hospital systems, and with payers, right? And so I actually think between those businesses, I got a very well-rounded view of the healthcare ecosystem, which, you know, we all know is very complex. When you look at the differences in motivations and issues and incentives for the various stakeholders actually who are coming together to deliver care for patients.
Interesting. And then I see you spent some time at McKinsey after that. What was that, what drew you there?
Yeah, well, that ended up sort of being unexpected. Honestly, as I said, I went into business school not expecting, you know, a lot of business school, especially out of Penn, there were about, I would say, a third of people either went to consulting or investment banking, maybe even a half, right? That's the drive. I really wanted to go into industry. And what was interesting is around my time when I was at Cordis, that was when J&J was in agreements to acquire Guidant. It was over that period of time.
Tell me about that. Yeah, yeah.
And so when I went back to school, I had an offer to go back to Cordis. My plan was to go back to Cordis. A couple things happened. One, that deal fell through around that period of time. So it wasn't that there was an opportunity to go back. It was just less clear exactly what was going to happen with the J&J mm-hmm. MedTech business with that sort of different landscape. The other thing is my wife and I started looking at it more closely. She still had two more years of residency. She was going to be in Philadelphia. Cordis was in northern New Jersey. How would we do this? Would we live in the middle and commute? She was going to be taking calls, working 85 hours a week. How would we really do that? Mm-hmm. And then I had some friends who had spent the summer at McKinsey, and McKinsey was just happened to be opening a Philadelphia office at that exact time period. And I thought, well, it's something I could go do for 2 years. It probably doesn't close any options for me if I can even get the offer, right? Mm-hmm. Went to an information session, liked what they had to see, liked what they had to her. I think it was different than other consulting firms in that I could really focus on healthcare. So McKinsey mm-hmm. has a model where you can go in and focus on healthcare and not be more of a generalist like you see with some of the other firms. So that was really important to me. And the Philadelphia office was part of the New Jersey complex, which did a lot of healthcare. Mm-hmm. So I ended up going to an information session, liked what I heard, went through the interview process, not really thinking you would go anywhere, got an offer and said, well, I'll do this for 2 years until my wife's done with residency and then figure out where to go from there. Fast forward 2 years, she was then matching for fellowship. So I've really just been following her around my whole life.
You didn't go to medical school for a reason. Then you ended up getting drawn to all this drama anyway.
Exactly. So she was looking for fellowships. I'm from the Bay Area originally. She's from New York. I said, let's go try the Bay Area. If you can match for a fellowship, let's go try it out. She ended up matching at UCSF in a cornea specialist, this specialty. I transferred with McKinsey, which committed me to another 2 years when I made that move. And so there was there for two more years. And then at that point I made junior partner, associate principal. And so I said, I had always said to myself, I'm just 2 years and I'm going to go do something different. Well, the next 2 years I'm going to go do something different. And then I got promoted and I said, well, I'll figure out, do I really want to be a partner here or not? Because mm-hmm. I think once you commit to being a partner, it's 5 years plus. And in that period, still loved the work, but decided, no, I really want to get back to being in industry. Mm-hmm. And decided at that point to make a move.
And so you moved from there to Thoratec, which is a great company to move to. Was that the leap? So what was it that drew you there? And you spent quite a number of years in cardiac, it seems. I did.
I think there were a couple things. One, just a really interesting space, and a really interesting patient population. I was drawn to the, especially at that period of time, LVADs had been used for bridge to transplant for a long period of time. But the idea mm-hmm. of using this as destination therapy for patients who were never going to be eligible for transplant, but needed something, was something that was really important to me. And I think it's a theme that I've sort of started to look back on and realize the things I've been most excited about and passionate about are technologies that are truly paradigm shifting. Right. I think everything that we do in healthcare and developing devices and technologies is important. Right. But for me, where I get the most value is where you're really able to drive a paradigm shift in care and a very substantial clinical outcome for the patient. So mm-hmm. so here you're taking patients who are on death's doorstep, right? Literally, often, days or hours away from dying and literally bringing them back to the point where they can, take walks, play golf, hang out with their grandkids again, be with their mm-hmm. families again. It's a very fundamental change in patient experience and change in outcome, which is really what drew me to Thoratec. And the opportunity, I think I was also drawn to sort of the mid-size company, and an opportunity to really come in and have impact mm-hmm. Across the business in a smaller organization than say maybe, again, nothing against these, but say that maybe a Medtronic or an Abbott or something else where you're going to be part of a much larger machine.
Sure.
I think at a smaller organization, probably it's another theme as I've been through multiple organizations since I left McKinsey, something I've been drawn to is the ability to see that impact and see the impact of my work more directly on the business and on the team and on the patient population.
So did you follow, because I see you were at St. Jude and then at Abbott, did you sort of just go along with each
acquisition? I sort of took the acquisition ride. When Thoratec was acquired by St. Jude Medical, they sort of let go the senior leadership team of Thoratec and integrated the rest of us in. So I sort of ended up being one of the last standing senior leaders on the commercial side at Thoratec that got integrated into St. Jude Medical. And after my first 6 or so months there, ended up getting promoted to run the heart failure franchise for St. Jude, which ended up including not just the mechanical circulatory support portfolio of Thoratec, but CardioMEMS, which was a hemodynamic monitoring sensor, which they had launched a few years prior, but it sort of come out of the gate strong, but then saw some real challenges commercially. So I ended up also being responsible for sort of the reconfiguration of that marketing approach and that commercial approach. As you know, St. Jude acquired Thoratec. About 12 months later, we ended up getting acquired by Abbott. So It was pretty quickly into there. I was into the Abbott world. And it was actually a very interesting process because I learned a lot about organizational styles and organizational constructs. You know, Thoratec had very much a business unit structure. St. Jude Medical moved to very much a matrix functional structure. So everybody lived in functions instead of business units. So That was a very big shift from Thoratec. And then we got acquired by Abbott and we went back to the business unit structure, right? So I think for me, there were a couple things. I learned a lot and had some amazing experiences with leadership across those two experiences. But I think, a couple things. One, that shifts, you start to learn as a consultant, you talk about integrations and how to do integrations and how to manage culture and the experience. And I lived it for the first time, right? That's hard on people when you shift organizational structure, organizational dynamic, reporting structures, and doing those shifts twice in a 24-month period was a lot for the whole team. But I also think I came to realize for the first time, there's a lot of impact you can have in a big organization, but where I get the most value is, working with my teams, working with the patients, working with clinicians. And in the bigger organizations, I found myself especially at that more senior level, managing across mm-hmm. my peer group and managing up for management and less time on those things that I just got more personal satisfaction out of. So it was about 6 months into the Abbott integration, and Keith Grossman, who was the former CEO of Thoratec, was chairman of the board of Outset Medical, which is where I landed next, and said, got this really interesting business that it's dialysis. So totally different world, still an end stage patient population, right? You're still talking about, it's just not the heart that's failing, it's the kidney that's failing. So it's still a similar patient population. But we're just getting ready to launch commercially. We sort of got the product going. We need somebody to help come in and learn leading sort of commercial and corporate strategy. That point introduced me to the CEO, Leslie Trigg, who you probably Fantastic. Know.
No, sure.
And was immediately taken by the whole idea of the opportunity there. Again, I think it's not there. There's when I joined Outset, there was not a clear path from A to C on that, right? Mm-hmm. You entered a business where the company was originally developed and founded around home hemodialysis, and we ended up taking the company and saying, flipping it on its head in those early days and saying, no, we're gonna start in the hospital. We're actually gonna start at the other end mm-hmm. of the care paradigm. And of the care continuum and treat patients in the ICU and at the bedside in hospitals, and then slowly expand into the outpatient setting and into home. And so was there, but for me, it was also struck by, again, this is an opportunity where to have huge patient impact. If you've been in a dialysis clinic,
sure.
if you understand what those patients are going through, it's pretty terrible, right? 4 hours, 3 days a week, not to mention commuting time. And the fact that they're usually totally wiped out for 12 to 24 hours after their treatment, the vision of being able to give them a better solution was very compelling to me.
And then how did Axon come about? Outset is a fantastic company, and you went on to be vice president of strategy and GM of home.
Yeah.
So you did move in that direction, as you said, you ultimately did. But what led you to Axon, and how I imagine that being a CEO was something that you had in mind, something you wanted to do?
It was, when I was at Outset, we went from pre-commercial. By the time I left that full year, we did $100 million in revenue. Mm-hmm. We had taken the company public in 2020. I was part of that process with Leslie and Rebecca Chambers, the CFO at the time. And I was starting to think through what was next for me. You know, was it a newer or different role as we continued to grow the business at Outset? Or, and it was around that time Axon came looking for a CEO. They were looking for, I joke, they were looking for someone with heart failure experience in the Bay Area of California. I think I was maybe the only guy that fed that overlapping diagram. That's how I ended up getting the job. But I think they were looking for somebody, you know, the company at the time was very early stage, right? So this was a shift for me, not just in that it was a CEO role, but that it was very early stage, right? They had done, you know, maybe 15 or 20 patients open label, had good proof of concept, and were just embarking on a randomized feasibility study. I think the benefit of an incredible investor syndicate with Deerfield, Action Potential Ventures, there was a good strategic involved. And the technology was founded out of Caridia. Howard Levin, Mark Gelfin, these guys had done a lot of cardiac technology development in their time. And they made the decision, look, heart failure is hard. It's complicated. We're never going to know what we have here until we do a randomized blinded study, right? We can do 60 patients open label, but you're never really going to know. So that's where I started. So again, this was a major shift for me, not just in being CEO, but very early stage clinical strategy. It was a phenomenal experience. We ran the feasibility study. We ended up doing almost 150 patient randomized feasibility study, which is, you know, not been done in very commonly. And, you know, we looked at the results at the end of 2023, and unfortunately it was neutral, right? There was at the aggregate level in HFpEF, which, as we've seen from other studies, now you've got Corvia, their results in HFpEF. You've got V-Wave, who also was treating a HFpEF patient population, both of those with intra-atrial shunts, saw sort of initial negative results in a HFpEF patient population. We saw something similar in HFpEF. I think there's a responder group. We've identified a pool of patients that we actually think can do quite well with the therapy and make sense from a mechanism of action on why they would do well, and also make sense on why those who didn't do well probably shouldn't do well. Mm-hmm. But you know, as in this funding environment, it became clear it was going to be challenging to, you know, from a time and investment perspective, to get to the answer. Mm-hmm. I think the view is we need to do a confirmatory. So the company needs to do a confirmatory study in advance of pivotal, and then they need to go run a big heart failure pivotal study. So you're probably looking at another $80-100 million and 5 to 7 years to get it across the finish line. And so it was around that time sort of realizing that's where we were going to be. And I think the syndicate figuring out we probably got to do something different here to figure out a path forward, that Phagenesis, you know, sort of came out and was looking for someone in the U.S. to drive commercialization in the U.S. and sort of lead the business into the next phase.
I want to get into Phagenesis next, but I just want to understand what is, as far as all the experiences you've had in your career, I have to think that moment of where you have decided that this path is not a path forward you can follow at the moment, that probably is among the most educational, I would imagine, like really to reach that point.
Well, I think that whole process and the broader impact of, you know, you have a company of people, you get a negative trial result. It's one thing if you're at a very large organization, right? Yeah. And that's part of business, and people will move on and to a different project, right? When you get that at a company of 20 people, that's a very different experience. So learning how to manage that in that process, you know, where we had to lay people off and start to rethink about how we're going to reconfigure the business was a ton of learning in all of that, which is very hard and difficult. But it did crystallize for me as well. Where do I want to be? Where do I want to be spending my time? And in the same way that I learned from being at some larger organizations, I like the smaller, I like the more hands-on, I like the more seeing the direct impact of my work. I think I realized, you know, I want to be commercial. I want to be on the commercial side of things. I want to be at the point where we're implementing and changing paradigms of care versus at the point where we're still learning if the science works or not. And so I think that moment for me, that time at Axon was a huge learning in that respect, right? That, you know, finding this model where you're still early enough that you're going to see the impact of your work on patients day to day, but late enough that, you know, it's not so early that you're still trying to figure out if the science works or
not. Right. Now there's definitely that sweet spot. So you found a great spot with Phagenesis. Let's talk a bit about the company and its neurostimulation system. How does it work, and where in the body are you stimulating?
Yeah. So it's a really simple procedure. I'll take a step back. I sort of first heard about this. I was a little like, oh, this is interesting. How big is this patient population really? What does this really mean? I had personal experience with this because my mom had a stroke a couple years ago, and she had dysphagia, which is essentially trouble swallowing, right? She had trouble swallowing after her stroke, and I mm-hmm. saw the impact that had on her in terms of, one, just trouble eating. You know, eating is one of the most basic things we do.
Sure.
But two, her trouble eating translated into her lack of desire to go out and do things. You know, you think about the things we do socially, a lot of that's around food and meals.
Sure.
And she didn't want to go out to eat anymore. She didn't want to go out with her friends anymore because she was having trouble swallowing. So I saw not just the impact on her from a physical perspective, but an emotional perspective as well. So it became a really, you know, that sort of triggered for me, this is a really big problem. And I think when I realized, I started digging into it, I didn't realize how big a problem it really is.
Mm-hmm.
In stroke alone, over 50% of patients have post-stroke dysphagia that's persistent, and it's independently correlates with all kinds of terrible outcomes in terms of higher mortality, longer lengths of stay, higher risk of ventilation, longer ventilation, pneumonia, all these terrible, terrible things, which drives a ton of cost and complexity in the healthcare system.
Mm-hmm.
So it's funny, this problem, everybody, you sort of mentioned this at the beginning, everybody talks about stroke, right? The impact of stroke. And right now there's a lot of focus on the front end of treating stroke. But I think nobody understands as much the follow-on issue of managing stroke,
right?
And how these types of conditions actually drive to a very high cost and complexity in the healthcare system for hospital systems and payers and for patients. So mm-hmm. now the beauty of the Phagenix system is it's super simple and elegant solution. It's a neurostimulator, so it basically goes down into the throat, into the pharynx essentially, mm-hmm. and provides an electrical stimulation of the pharynx. And what that essentially does, in layman's terms, is it reboots the swallow reflex and the swallow neuropathway. So if you think about a stroke, traumatic brain injury, or even prolonged ventilation can lead to sort of a jumbling of that pathway. And I think of this as like the control alt delete or rebooting your router, right? It improves neuroplasticity and reboots that pathway so people regain their native swallowing reflex and function. It's no implant, so you don't leave anything behind. There's no surgical procedure required. And the beauty of it is it's built into the existing workflow for these patients in the hospital. So, you know, the company was founded out of the University of Manchester. Shaheen Hamdi and Connor Mulrooney were the original founders. Connor's still our COO, and Shaheen's still chief scientific advisor. What they decided to do is they decided to build a nasogastric feeding tube into the neurostimulator. So most of these patients are getting a nasogastric feeding tube today because they have nutritional deficits because mm-hmm. of their inability to swallow. So they built that in. So patients are getting a nasogastric feeding tube. Its placement of this type of device is part of the standard of care anyway. And all that's required is the patient gets 10 minutes of treatment, you know, 3 to 6 days, and it helps regain their swallowing function with the intent of, you know, improving swallowing function, reducing, you know, improving nutritional intake, which then should result in reducing, the need for reintubation, for permanent feeding tubes, potential to reduce aspiration pneumonia, and improve the likelihood of the patient being discharged into the home setting as opposed to being discharged into skilled nursing or long-term acute care.
So is the nasogastric tube, is that implanted immediately after the stroke and during the time in the hospital, or is that something that, and is it removed before they're discharged someplace, or is that?
I mean, it's sort of, it varies depending on the patient's need, right? Yeah. You know, so these can be placed sort of immediately after the stroke. They can be placed as part of a ventilation tube, an intubation as mm-hmm. well. And it sort of depends on the model of care. The intent would be it gets placed, the patient gets treated, right? And then you're able to remove the tube, they're swallowing under their own function, and then they're able to be discharged without the need for a permanent feeding tube, which is increasingly common here in the US and leads to all kinds of problems and an increased likelihood of discharging them to home.
So I assume that your stimulation would be a permanent implant that would be used, controlled by the patient, used to help with the swallowing process, but it's not that at all. It's more of a physical therapy, almost sort of.
You know, that's actually a great way to think about it. It's physical therapy that doesn't require a patient to participate. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. So, you know, one of the things I remember from my mom's stroke was all the neurologists and all the therapists said most of her function, speech and swallow, is going to come back in the first 30 days, maybe even the first 2 weeks. And it's going to be highly dependent on how much work she puts in to the rehab.
Okay.
Right. And so rehab, which is kind of the best tool speech language pathologists have today to support speech and swallow function, requires patient engagement. And if you think about the first 2 weeks or the first 30 days post-stroke, especially a severe stroke, that's hard to get, right? These patients have a lot going on. They may have a lot of limitations. And so what this does is this provides a highly targeted intervention that directly impacts neuroplasticity without the need for any patient engagement.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So how is this, where does this sort of fall in the economics of things? Because you're treating something that is it specifically diagnosed as something that needs to be treated, and is there a code associated with that helps you get paid, or are you sort of included in a larger payment that goes along with treating a patient who just had a person who just had a stroke?
Yes. So
it is healthcare after all. It's not going to be a
problem. Yeah, right. I didn't want to say it depends, but no. I mean, the answer is yeah. We both, right? So we do. The company has FDA approval, achieved breakthrough device designation. As part of that, they got NTAP. So we have NTAP today. So we are getting incremental reimbursement when providers use the technology. And then it does fall under the broader DRG in which the patient is being managed. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing, which I don't think is well understood, and I think is actually one of our big challenges, is I think if you go talk to a neurocritical care physician, they will tell you, yes, dysphagia is actually one of the drivers of need for reintubation, longer length of stay, mm-hmm. higher rate of aspiration pneumonia, higher rate of needing a permanent feeding tube surgery, and a higher rate of discharge to a skilled nursing facility or LTAC versus home, right? Once you get more broadly outside of that stroke neurointensive care unit, I think a lot, you know, SLPs, speech language pathologists understand it, but I think you get into administration, there's a lack of understanding that actually dysphagia is independently predictive of higher mortality, poorer outcome, and higher cost.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you treat these patients, and we have loads of data from Europe that show if you treat these patients early, you can see very significant reductions in the need for reintubation, very significant reductions in the length of stay, you know, honestly on the order of 7 to 15 day reductions in length of stay for some of these sicker patient populations. Reductions in the rate of aspiration pneumonia and significant reductions or increases in the rate of discharge to home as opposed to the rate of discharge to a skilled nursing or LTAC rehab facility. So there's a very compelling health economic story with this technology. In addition to what we've talked about, let's not forget the compelling patient impact letting people swallow again. So
absolutely. Is the need evident in certain patients who have had a stroke that this person will need treatment for?
Have
compromised ability to swallow, or is it something that every patient should be given just as a preemptive measure to
No, I think it's not every patient. I think, okay. I think there's definitely indicators and we're still figuring this out too. Right. Yeah. By the way, but I think there's indicators around, depending on location of the stroke in the brain can be more or less predictive of likeliness of dysphagia. Ventilation is clearly correlated and maybe causal with dysphagia. And if you kind of think about that, that makes sense. If I've got a tube down my throat, that's constantly pushing on my throat, which would normally, if you have something in your throat, that's what instigates the swallow reflex. Mm-hmm. Well, if I've got something constantly in my throat, you can understand how the swallow reflex would go away because your brain just says, I got to stop because I'm not doing what I need to be doing. So patients who've been ventilated, clearly have issues with swallowing. Patients who get tracheostomized, because those patients clearly have issues. So there's definitely a subset of those patients that are more likely to have dysphagia that is persistent and that doesn't resolve on its own over time. And those patients are also the patients, by the way, that are the most costly and difficult to manage for providers, right? Being able to extubate someone and if they can't manage their secretions, if they can't manage their saliva, you have to reintubate them. Right. And I didn't realize, I think about swallowing as being important because you can eat and you can drink and you can do all these things, provide nourishment. If you can't swallow, you can't breathe. Right. That's the other thing. So it's almost as important as breathing, because if you can't swallow, if you can't manage your secretions, you can't breathe on your own. Yeah. Those patients become incredibly difficult to manage for these hospitals.
Do you have a precedent company, something? This is a unique problem and a unique way to treat it and sort of, I think, a unique life cycle for a medical device. Is there another company out there that's had a similar experience, a path that you're following toward commercial acceptance?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, there's definitely other analogs. I think the one that's maybe most obvious, which is a little bit different, is Ceribell is in a similar world, right? Where it's neuro, it's ICU. They're trying to demonstrate that using their technology to sort of triage seizure and other issues earlier can help reduce cost of care, length of stay, and all of these other things, right? Mm-hmm. So I think they're very similar to what we're doing. We run into them a lot as we think about our who we're talking to and who we're selling to. So I think they're probably a good analog of what's required here.
Who are you talking to and who are you selling to? Are you talking to hospital administrators who see the benefits of shortened stay? Are you talking to the physicians?
I think this is, I think the other way to think about this is this is almost like, I don't want to say it's as complicated as implementing a new service line, but I think what we're learning is that, especially here in the US where we've just still got very early commercial experience, it is very much a multi-stakeholder sale, right? Neurology is important. They're managing the patient in most cases, neurocritical care. They're managing the most difficult to manage of these patients. They see the impact on a clinical basis. I think typically we're seeing speech language pathology is involved in sort of truly identifying and diagnosing patients and swallowing level of swallowing dysfunction. And right now they're doing the treatment, and then administration's critical for us to be able to articulate the value and how we're going to drive value for the institution, health economic value for the institution. So I think about this as like, it's probably more rather than just we're selling a disposable. It is a bit more of, more of a capital like process or a program implementation like process, where we need to bring the various stakeholders together to understand the impact this condition's having on their institution. We've got data that shows in this institution, patients with dysphagia can be costing as much as $15,000 to $30,000 per admission more than those who don't have dysphagia. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure people are totally aware of dysphagia as an indicator of that. And then demonstrating how we can help them solve that problem, right? It reduce length of stay, improve outcomes, and improve their health economic outcomes for the institution.
And if someone has dysphagia after suffering a stroke 6 months ago, a year ago, or more, is this something that can help them, or does it need to happen right away after the?
No, we've actually got data pretty far out, which is one of the interesting things. I think most people think about these types of benefits. Like I've said, most of it would say, hey, what happens in the first 30 days? We've actually shown real benefit after people have even been discharged from the hospital or in the outpatient setting. And so we're exploring that. You know, it's likely maybe a slightly different care model, how you administer the treatment on an outpatient basis versus an inpatient basis. So we're really focused in the acute care setting for now, because we think that's, and we've seen that's probably where we can deliver the most health economic value. But I think there's no question that as a sort of phase two growth for us is, how do you then expand into that outpatient setting, post-acute care, outpatient, right? You also have a lot of patients who are sort of languishing in LTACs and skilled nursing facilities because of swallowing dysfunction, right? So that's another phase of growth for us. But I think, you know, you got to pick somewhere to start. You got to pick a beachhead. And we know that we can create the most value, probably have the largest patient impact, if we can solve the problem earlier in the continuum of care rather than waiting to solve it after all these other bad things have already happened, right? After they already have a permanent feeding tube, after they've sat in long-term acute care for months and they're home.
The setting trajectory sounds a bit like Outset, where you said you focused on intensive care and then moved outward. Is that,
I would say it's similar.
Interesting. And just finally, the financials, you closed on a $42 million Series D. Were you involved with that at all, or did you?
I was not. The former CEO, Ryan, did all the hard work on that one. But I have to say the company's in a phenomenal position just in terms of, you know, where we are from a regulatory approval perspective, where we are from a clinical data perspective in Europe, and funding, right? So over $40 million to sort of get us through this next phase of growth with an amazing investor syndicate. I mean, it was also one of the things that was really attractive. You've got, you know, EQT Life Science Partners, Sectoral, Affilion in their Cardiation Enterprise, which is partnered with the AHA, and then out of the UK, British Patient Capital and Northern Gritstone, who are very sort of mission-driven organizations. I feel like we've actually got a really nice balance around the boardroom of an investor syndicate of, you know, financial and mission-driven investors who are both about, you know, how do we improve things for patients? How do we deliver better care? How do we improve the lives of our providers as well? But how do we do it in a financially responsible way too? So I'm super excited about the syndicate we've put together that's really enabling this next phase of growth.
That's great. And what is next? Just to recap, what are the next few years look like for?
No,
for
great question. I mean, I think. There's a couple elements of this. One, I think, is really driving a better understanding around dysphagia and the impact it has, you know, not just on patients. I think everybody gets that. But I think what is not fully appreciated is, you know, how this really drives a ton of costs and complexity in the healthcare system. And we can all do better, right? There's already a strong base of business in Europe. And I think it's really around building that in a responsible sort of thoughtful way about how do we expand and sort of expand the circle that we're treating in the European market. And then it's really, you know, cracking the code on the US market, right? And as I said, while they've had FDA approval for a little while, and while there's been, well, we have NTAP, you know, the funding really has just started to enable expansion of the commercial group in the US. And so it'll be really about building that commercial and expanding the commercial presence in the US. But then also, as I mentioned, we have a ton of clinical data. Most of it is European data. And you know, US physicians and clinicians don't appreciate European data as much as they do US data. And so really in parallel to that commercial expansion and footprint is really around how do we sort of continue to build the clinical evidence around the use in the US care model, which is different than Europe. And so building that out. So I think those are sort of, as I think about it, really the three pillars of growth is how do we drive a better understanding of the impact this is having on people today and leverage that to continue to drive growth in Europe and really build the US footprint on a go forward basis.
Fantastic. All right. Well, great story, Chad. Thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Absolutely. Appreciate it. Thanks for the time.
Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Once again, join us on Tuesdays for Resonetics Device Talks Tuesday. The title of that is Advanced MedTech with Custom Electromechanical Sensors from Design to Deployment. Resonetics always puts on a great show. I hope you'll join us there. Also, Device Talks Boston registration is open. Yes, it is. We'll be there April 30th and May 1st. Be among the first to register for Device Talks Boston. And we'd love to see you there. We're going to have a great 2 days of networking and insights and all the great stuff you love from conferences. Finally, don't forget to subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network so you don't miss a future episode of our Device Talks, our growing Device Talks Podcast Network. We rolled out Neuro Innovation Talks just last month. We're rolling out our second episode. We're rolling out additional episodes of Structural Heart Talks, Abbott Talks, and our other great podcasts, Device Talks AI, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, the flagship Device Talks Weekly. So please subscribe. Please share this episode on social media. And if you're being difficult and you're not going to do any of that, the very least, just connect with me on LinkedIn. Connect with Kayleen Brown on LinkedIn. She's our managing editor. And of course, connect with Chris Newmarker of Mass Device on LinkedIn. All right, folks, we'll have another episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast coming your way next week. Take care, everybody.